Hello, and welcome to What We Just Watched from TV Cream. I'm Chris.
And I'm Ian.
And today, we're going to start with my show. Okay, so we're ready to go. Maybe, Ian, you could tell me what you're seeing on screen.
In front of me is a colour slide of Jim Bergerac. BBC Globe is spinning. Oh, Bob says opportunity knocks.
So maybe you could tell us what's happening on the screen.
A TV set has opened up in front of us with various drawings and animations.
Animated performers, jugglers and magicians. Yes.
Goodness. And then, starring Bob Monkhouse, of course. And the,
so now
runaway. Yes, there
we're
he is.
Going to watch.
There he
is. Bob says opportunity knocks. So we've just watched Bob Says Opportunity Knocks from Saturday the 10th of April 1987. So Ian, or perhaps I should say Star Maker, what did you make of that?
Well, I should say first of all that I never watched this programme
really?
When it was first going out.
Really? No, is there any particular reason?
I'm not sure. I don't recall my family ever watching this. Mm. I don't know whether it was because... Well, it was on... What sort of time of evening
was it on? Saturday night, mid-evening, 8
yeah,
o'clock.
Yeah, I think by that point we probably... We used to watch Saturday TV early evenings, mm-hmm. but then I'm not sure. I don't recall ever really watching anything later. And so this, for me, was a bit of a revelation.
Okay.
And I suppose on balance I enjoyed it, though I have a few issues with it.
Okay.
But that might be more to do with... What has followed on afterwards in terms of TV talent shows?
That's one of the things I wanted to talk about, because this is kind of a keynote show in that I think this is the first talent show where viewers could phone in to cast a vote.
Once again, our Bob Knox hotline will open up over 500 lines as this show goes off the air at 8:30.
So in that sense, it's a very kind of influential show. But in other senses, it's still kind of... quite a formulaic and slightly old-fashioned show. It's very much variety, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Which, watching it now, I think that is probably the element which is, to me, is the most problematic, because the type of acts which it features, they seem to be kind of caught between the past and the future,
it's,
really.
It's 1987, isn't it? But it could be 1977.
Yes.
It could be, for some acts, it could have been 1957.
I remember reading in Bob's own book about how he took great pride in going to all the auditions.
Yeah.
Some of the acts were really so good, we gave them a booking. Some were fair, we gave them a recall. Some were not ready, we gave them advice. One fellow was so awful... We gave him a blankety-blank checkbook and pen.
So I guess I detect his imprint on this programme very much.
If you're looking in, use them in good health, Les.
What did you make of Bob's sort of role as the compere?
Well, I think he's obviously loving it.
Yes.
But he invests a lot, I think, into trying to create a rapport between you at home and the studio. Yeah.
Well... We didn't think you could do it, but you did. You surpassed yourself, Star Makers. Your phone-in vote was phenomenal.
Yeah. The fact that he's always referring to us as Star Makers.
Did you like that?
I
quite like that.
Did you?
Well, it kind of imbues it with a sense of, you know, you've got an investment in the show.
Yes, that's true. Yes, you're
right. Quite a tricky role, I think, that he's got, particularly when he's dealing with comedians, in that he can't overshadow the comics. But also, you know, he obviously doesn't want to dial down his act, so it's got a kind of quite tricky sort of tightrope to walk.
Did you know this? Every day Michael Crawford takes 2.5 hours to put on his makeup and look like the Phantom of the Opera. It takes my wife 7 minutes to take off her makeup and look like the Phantom of the Opera.
But I think there's a little bit of danger in that coming out of an act that hasn't really worked. you sense that Bob probably thinks he has to then compensate to pick up the atmosphere, pick up the energy again. And hence, after the stand-up comic,
Ivor
Problem.
It would have been funnier if he'd been called that, I feel.
Yes. I think it was noticeable that Bob felt he almost had to step in.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you on behalf of Act Number 2, Ivor Richards. A really lovable, funny man. You can imagine how he brightened up our auditions for us. And we needed it that day, because we'd had an awful day with the auditions. We'd waited about an hour for this escapologist. It turned out he was locked in the gents and couldn't get out.
I think back then, the notion that you would kind of show the auditions, and that would have been seen like a kind of bizarre notion. But now we kind of accept that as kind of that's part of the process.
Yeah, and that's very astute of Bob to include that in the show, even though another element that's also included, which is the little snippets of films, the profile.
Welcome to the Cheltenham Gold Cup. My name's Steve Harvey. And as you can see, I'm a big racing fan.
Again, I think when we were watching the show, you sort of said these are kind of like the antecedents of of the VTs that we get on Strictly now.
Exactly. And one thing I have to say that hasn't changed through the years is how excruciating these are. Yeah.
I suppose show business is a gamble, but it shouldn't be this hard to get a bet on.
It's a problem they still haven't solved nowadays, which is to... I suppose, what's the point of it? It's to introduce you
to the
character, the
personality. You know, you would call it the backstory, wouldn't you?
Yes, I suppose, yeah. It shows them beginning their journey.
Yes.
Through the programme.
Well, should we talk a bit about the six acts?
You know, if we have to.
Well, I think there's a lot to talk about with most of them.
Oh, go on then.
So we begin with the returning champion.
Yes, folks, it's Tony Warne!
And it's interesting in that kind of now the sort of the accepted formula for a kind of talent show is that you have a pool of acts who are whittled down one by one each week. Whereas with Bob Knox, it's a different bill of contestants every week, except that the winner from the previous week comes back.
There's no sense of momentum or moving towards a conclusion. Bob says, he does say at one point, you're only allowed four appearances, isn't that right?
Yeah.
It seems a rather arbitrary figure to have. But I guess somehow then this adds up. The show collects its finalists as it goes on. And then at the very end, they all come back.
Yeah.
But in this instance, it's a child singing.
She's dressed. Basically, she's auditioning for Annie.
It's awful. She looks like she's come from Georgian England. And she sings it with as little charisma as possible. Open the light that
burns so brightly, suddenly birds are pale. Is there any way in which an 8-year-old child could sing Bright Eyes and it be entertaining? Bright Eyes, burning light. Now, Ian, I have to ask you, which other TV talent show did Tony Warne appear on?
Oh, what? Do you mean at the time or in later years?
In later years.
Did she come back then?
She did come back.
Was she on... has she tried her luck on The X Factor then?
No. He, just like I said. She was on The Voice UK, so she kind of had this weird span of, almost 30 years.
That's a long time.
Of talent shows.
Come on, just turn around.
So, next on the bill, we've got Ivor Richards, who is the very definition, I think, of the trad stand-up comic, isn't he? Sydach chi ma'n ddau bod y fama o pobol gyd, dach chi'n gwybod fama, mae Sue Pollard i sefyll y fama. There's Dawson. I don't know why I'm talking like this for. I left Wales when I was four. Kind of the range of material he was doing would have slotted quite nicely into 1970s stand-up.
In fact, it would have slotted better into the climate of the 70s than in the late 80s.
Well, are we saying that Ivor Richards' material was slightly casually racist?
Slightly.
And the Japs will be taking over. Can you imagine what effect it would have on television? Take sport. Next week we've got the snooker, the World Championship. The commentator, Ted Lowe, in Japanese.
It's all a bit distasteful, and I think even at the time I would suggest that it was out of place.
Did
because by 87, you're far enough through the 80s for I think, anyway. From memory, anyway, society has already changed enough by that point.
Well, that'll be next. Next year's Grand National.
I'm afraid I didn't really like any of his act. And also, he didn't have any variety. It was like, well, I've got the idea of someone as if they were Japanese. And then he just replicates that again and again and again.
Then it would be the children's programmes. They'd be bringing back John Noakes out of retirement.
What if so-and-so was Japanese?
A lot so-and-so. Like he'd cherry-picked what he might have regarded as his best material and sort of bolted it all together. There was no thread to that routine, was there?
I went shopping. Oh, the sales. All them women. I couldn't move. They were shoving me, prodding me, rubbing their bodies up against me. I can't wait till Monday.
He hadn't thought about constructing it as a whole. It was just, it's almost as if he'd run through that morning. Oh, I'll do the gag about the Japanese, the gag about the shops, a funny voice, and that's it.
So next, it's the singer, Steve Harvey. Everything has its seasons, everything has its time. Perhaps, Ian, you could talk a little about what he's wearing.
Well, he appears dressed in what I would say is classic mid-80s.
Oh, absolutely.
Soft rock wardrobe. He's got a jacket rolled up to the sleeves.
Yeah.
Shirt buttoned right up to the top.
Yeah, no tie.
No tie, but some sort of little shiny
clasp or a little brooch or something
at the top.
Yeah.
And then trousers and shoes. And his hair has been teased into this rather luxuriant perm, which I thought made him look a bit like Cher. But then later on, Bob actually talks to him about who he thinks he looks like.
I must say this because so many people looking in must be saying, who does Steve look like? Who's the fellow in Aha?
Morton Harkett.
That's right. And there's somebody else, Knight Rider.
David Hasselhoff.
Don't you think so?
And I think he really suffers from being put in a slot in the show, which is the kind of way you'd bury someone. It's the middle.
Is it kind of like the same on Eurovision where kind of people say, oh, you're 14th, yes, you're not going to win.
That's right. There's this thing about, oh, it's good if you're either on early or on late.
Yeah.
But if you're in the middle, well, anyway.
Yeah.
I think it's the sort of song that you've forgotten about before it's even ended. Rivers below,
where they can ramble. It doesn't serve him well, really. I can't even remember what it was like. I've got to be
where my spirit can run free. No, that says it all.
And then so we come to the fourth act on the bill.
Tracy Hughes and the Moppo Crump.
Now, Ian, could you in any way sum up the Moppo Crump?
Well, it's a person inside a large costume which looks a bit like a giant sheep.
But pink. Yeah.
It's kind of like a mound of fur.
It's meant to be a creature, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
but there's someone inside there.
Protruding from this lump is a long neck with a beak at the end.
Oh, in the
it's
kind
an
of,
emu
it,
style.
In the style of emu.
Now, Molly, what are you going to do for us tonight? We're going to do an impression.
But it kind of makes the same noise that Ed the Duck would make in sort of late 80s, early 90s children's BBC.
Oi, you. I was about to talk about your screaming fans.
My biggest problem with this act isn't all the nonsense and the quacking and the fooling about. It's the fact that there's two people on stage, but only one of them is being credited. The poor person inside this costume is, to my money, is doing all the work.
So your biggest problem with this act is this administrative oversight.
It's bogus. We're being sold a pup.
What are you doing, Molly? You're thinking. Well, hurry up and think. Come on, quickly.
I think we need to talk a little, perhaps, about what the Moppo Crump does.
Well, it just is. It makes quacking noises.
But it does magic tricks here.
Well, that's the problem is, I get another problem. There are quite a few problems.
You've got a lot of problems with
well,
the Muppet
Crump. Well, as I was watching it, this only occurred to me, and you reminded me here, is that I forgot completely about that, because it got so lost in all the funny business and the silly goings-on. The fact that there actually is a genuine magic trick in there.
Molly, the trick's happening. Thank you. Would you like to pick a card, please, Jackie? Look at it, but don't show myself or Molly. Molly, no looking. That's cheating. That is cheating.
Yeah, it did actually get completely thrown away. I mean, it wasn't a very... Yeah, it's just a very simple card trick, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was just completely overshadowed by the
mayhem.
Yes,
in inverted
the zany goings on.
Now, Ian, I want to ask you, what do you think Tracy Hughes was hoping for? You know, if he could have wished for one particular big break out of his appearance on Opportunity Knocks.
I suppose a children's show, perhaps, of some
kind.
It's
a shame that Crackerjack had sort of finished.
Yeah, there wasn't
it would have slotted quite neatly into...
But then the magic trick makes me think he was kind of angling for, I don't know, a raw variety show.
Oh, you can definitely see, if things had gone a little better, you can definitely imagine that...
Tracy Hughes and Molly the Mopper Crump.
The Mopper Crump might be a slightly bit disrespectful to Her Majesty.
Molly!
So after the madness of the Mopper Crump, we get an a cappella group.
Dum, 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 dum.
The Balfour Chorus.
And I perked up when they appeared.
Did
yes.
you?
Yeah, because I thought, at last, a bit of talent.
So what do they perform?
They perform an a cappella version of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yes.
Which is well, there's a few things about this. The fact that I think it's very well chosen, because the moment the song begins, it's so well known that everyone thinks, they're doing Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
And then you start to think through your head, oh my goodness, they're going to have to do this bit and that bit. How are they going to do the middle bit and everything? So you're on tenterhooks all the way through, which is a real good strategy, whether it was deliberate or not, I don't know. But it...
I imagine that was like their showpiece number.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, the trick with that performance is in the arrangement as much as the performance.
Yes.
And, you know, it's really professionally done.
Yeah, I mean, it's done. It's almost pretty much faultless.
The lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo.
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 Galileo. Galileo.
Do you feel that whole sort of genre of a cappella singing and barbershop quartets is almost kind of an underrated skill, isn't it? People kind of deride, you know, the King Singers and...
Yeah, it's easy
whole,
to knock
them. Yeah, but it's really, really difficult.
It is, yeah. And I think the fact that they are on the same show as the man singing that song from a musical had that particular performer not already been rather overshadowed by the mop thing, his chances of winning are then completely go out the window when the barbershop quartet come along, because first of all, it's four times as many people singing as him, and they're not just singing; they are it's a skilled performance, it's a physical thing, as much as a musical thing.
Because, you know, all four of them have got to get it bang on.
Thank you.
It's about timing. It's about pitching it. It's all. It's so. It's not just you, one person performing to an audience. You listening to each other. You need to time everything. You need to get everything in sync. It's a real undertaking.
And so finally, we get 14-year-old impressionist Debbie Stevenson.
Hey, Gladys.
Who went on to become quite a sort of reasonably famous and successful actress. And still doing impressions.
Hey, Gladys, I want to be a yellow coat.
So she actually, you know, made something out of, you know, the act she did on Opportunity Knocks.
And she actually finishes top, doesn't she?
Yeah.
In the audience.
Yeah, yeah. Star value.
Star value, metric, measure, whatever you decide to call it.
Yeah.
The clapometer, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, she does do a very good job. She turns in... a veritable who's who of your 1980s lady impressions.
Nobody would have been disappointed with the kind of the selection of... And my favourite thing about her routine is that she refers to all of the people she does impressions of as her guests.
Hey, I hope you like poetry, because my next guest is Pam Ayres.
It's a very assured and confident performance for a 14-year-old. I'm guessing then that there must have been quite a low age...
Yeah.
Threshold,
yeah.
Which I suppose was one of the things which Bob was always keen to play out, the fact that it's all ages, no matter where you're from, backgrounds, everything else.
Well, that's kind of interesting in the fact that she starts by doing an impression of Marilyn Monroe.
That's not her strongest material.
And I can't imagine that a 14-year-old sort of doing that on TV now.
But very quickly, we're onto much safer, surer ground with the likes of Esther.
We got a letter from a Mr. Dorking of Woking.
I think the thing with most of her impressions is that they're kind of the stock, generic impression that anyone else on TV would have done. But her Esther Anson is quite good in that she kind of... Before she even speaks, she sort of does the kind of Esther Anson sort of that sort of concerned face.
She manages to her face contorts into a
it's
Esther
really good.
Countenance.
Yeah,
which is that's kind of half of the
and that weird sort of intonation and emphasis that Esther used to use. She also kind of delivers this slightly lame punchline to this joke in the same way that Esther Anson would deliver. The punchline to a lame joke.
I didn't know dentists had bills. This one did. He was a quirk.
Who else does she do? She does Pam Ayres, doesn't she?
Oh, I wish I'd looked after me teeth.
It's
Pam's most famous poem, and she just kind of does it.
Yeah.
She doesn't bring anything new to
it.
However, she sings a few more songs, one of which is Scylla.
Anyone who had a rod.
But as we remarked during it, she sings it not in the way that Scylla sings, but in the way Scylla speaks.
Yeah.
Knowing I love you.
But not even that, it's the version of Scylla speaking that any impressionist of the time would have done. If you imagine, I don't know, Les Dennis doing an impression of Scylla hosting Surprise Surprise, is that voice, and she's using that voice to sing.
So it's a kind of a sort of second iteration of Scylla. It's already passed through one version.
It's like a kind of, you know, kind of a photocopy that's been photocopied a few times. We need to talk about the kind of climax of the show, don't we? So once the six acts have all performed, we see them all again.
Yes.
But they're kind of doing kind of, if they're a singer, they kind of do a little kind of brief reprise of their song. But if they're a comedian or an impressionist, they get to do a whole new little bit of material.
This is particularly true of the impressionist because she wheels out both Sue Pollard and Ruth Madoc.
What did he say to you, Peggy?
Talking to each other.
Or Peggy and Gladys.
Sorry, yes. From Mighty Heart.
From yes. Maplin's.
And, I mean, yes, you don't. It's interesting, you don't get that on the shows nowadays. They don't. When you have the recaps, it's just a
VT, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And just imagine if on Strictly or The X Factor, they all came back on.
And dance for 10 seconds.
Another little bit. just to kind of remind you of it.
Yeah. How do you feel about the whole business with the clapometer?
But right now, we're going to measure the star value according to the reaction here in the studio at the BBC Television Centre.
Well, I mean, it's all a load of nonsense, isn't it?
I think during the show you were intimating that the clapometer might not have been particularly on the level.
There's no consistency to the way it behaves.
Would you like to have seen some kind of BBC sort of adjudicator and a kind of legal representative?
I'm surprised.
Looking
that,
at some kind of oscilloscope.
I'm surprised.
To determine whether the clapping was of a required level.
They missed a trick here. They should have had some large apparatus in the studio. And also, you don't actually see any evidence of it in the studio at all.
No.
Because Bob has to then tell...
It's just a graphic on the screen.
Bob has to tell the acts himself what they got. They don't see it. There's no official way of recording it, which, to me, is all a little bit suspect.
And also, the clapometer and the results of it are just a precursor to the actual vote.
Well,
so,
that's true, yeah.
So
yeah.
You could win on the clapometer, but actually you don't win the show. This seems very, from a modern perspective, that feels really unsatisfying.
The lines are about to open for your calls.
It's quite interesting, actually, that although Bob talks about kind of phoning in and you got the chance to sort of vote from home, at this point in the show's history, they didn't put the actual phone numbers on screen because, you know, BT and the BBC were worried that kind of the switchboard might have been jammed by...
I was really surprised by this because we get a lot of talk at the end about how we can vote, lots of ways we can take part, radio
Bob
times,
also talks about
newspapers.
I'll pop on after Bergerac to display the six numbers you can dial.
If we wanted to phone in and we hadn't got CFAX to hand, we'd have to sit all through Jim Bergerac's latest escapade.
That's no chore.
It's true. And I suppose it's a neat bit of schedule hokum.
1 hour ago this evening, Bob said opportunity knocks. And since then, your telephone votes have been coming in at the rate of 2,500 calls a minute. So if you've already voted, thank you for your call. And if you haven't, thank you for your patience. If you've not been able to get through, it just proves that thousands of people share your opinion. And you still have until midnight to register your vote. This is the hotline number. 0898 99 111. That last figure is up to you.
So Ian, from a kind of modern perspective, how do you feel Bob Says Opportunity Knock stands up?
I think the types of act on it, for the most part, stand up very well.
Yeah.
The only one that's really dated is the comic, I think. Because you still nowadays get musical theatre, impressionists, novelty acts, because I think I imagine the mop person would probably turn upon Britain's Got Talent nowadays, wouldn't
they? Well, I was going to ask you, Ian, of those six acts, if you had to enter one of those for
As if I was then? What?
Well, if you had to select one of those acts to go on Britain's Got Talent.
Well, it would be the mop.
What do you think?
Yes.
Because I would definitely go Balfour Chorus. Four clean-cut chaps singing Bohemian Rhapsody a cappella.
Classically trained music students G4 stunned the judges when they arrived.
Mama! Mama.
The audience would lap that up, surely.
That feels a bit... I wonder what they... I think they would have had success on something like Britain's Got Talent, maybe 10 years or so ago. I think maybe the mid-noughties rather than this decade.
Do you feel kind of the heat's gone out from Bohemian Rhapsody?
From the barbershop market. It's perhaps not as lively as once was.
I genuinely think kind of like the skill level required to perform like that would sort of sweep them through.
We are the Balfour Chorus. Girls just scream and fall down before us. We sing so loudly, how can you ignore us?
We're the one.
Two, three, Balfour Chorus.
And how did you feel about the other sort of omission from sort of modernise? Is there's no judges?
That is a good point. Yes, that's actually quite refreshing.
Yeah.
To see that. And yes, because the outcome is entirely in ordinary people's hands, isn't it?
Yeah.
No one is guiding us. Because they had judges on New Faces.
They did, yes.
But they were, again, they were more just sort of to give on-the-spot industry advice, weren't they? Because they were meant to be
experts. Yes. Yeah.
Who would help to refine the pool of talent.
Yes.
And then the audience would have the final say. Yeah. Whereas here, I guess the real hook of it is it's entirely down to us, the star makers.
Absolutely.
And if opportunity comes your way, don't knock it. Bye.
Okay, so Ian, if I were to give you the clapometer, how many marks out of 100 would you give Bob's Opportunity Knocks?
Well, Chris, claps out of 100, I would give Bob Knocks 85 claps out of 100.
Okay.
What we just watched, that's what we watched.
Well, now it's my turn to show Chris a programme. And Chris, this is a programme which gives away its identity in the very first frame.
Right.
Both in terms of what you'll see, but also what you'll hear.
Okay.
And so, as before, maybe it's easier if you just describe what you're seeing and hearing.
All right.
It's a little bit convoluted, but we can always pause it and explain exactly to listeners what's going on.
All right.
So here we go.
Okay. So we're seeing a large truck, which I assume to be the Challenge Annika truck.
It is indeed. Now, where is Annika?
It looks like she's outside Broadcasting House. We've got a graphic saying it's Wednesday, 7:45 a.m. We are indeed outside Broadcasting House. So I wonder whose radio show she's going to invade. Simon Mayo. There he is in the 1FM studios.
Right, well, we'll pause it there because we've already stuff is happening. And we'll watch the show and then come back and talk about it afterwards.
Excellent.
Okay, well, we just watched an edition of Challenge Annika, or the Challenge Programme.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
As she always referred to it on the show, from October 1989. Before we go any further, we should just summarise the challenge itself.
Yes.
It is to produce 10,000 copies from scratch of what is called a recycled joke book.
Yes.
The catch being that it needs to be on recycled paper.
Yes.
Very much the in thing.
It's 1989.
In the late 80s, yeah.
Green
environment issues, people are obsessed with ecology,
green issues,
And not only does she have to literally produce it in terms of printing it and distributing it, she has to source the jokes.
Yes.
And this provides much of the material for the opening of this edition.
I think that's the section of the programme I enjoyed the most.
Well, I've wondered whether, your opinion of the programme seemed to change as it went on. I could tell that you were quite interested and excited by the start, but not so much later on.
Well, I don't think that's entirely fair, but I think the highlight of the show is the opening sequence where she is dashing for no readily apparent reason.
But she's Annika Rice.
Yeah,
she's
got
to
got to run everywhere. So she's dashing into Broadcasting House to gate crash the studios of the Radio 1 breakfast show.
I don't really know what I'm doing here at Broadcasting House. I've just been told to come here, it's 7:45 in the morning, and find Simon Mayo.
And on the phone with the challenge,
it's Claire Sturgis
for some reason.
We have Claire Sturgis on the line. Hello, Claire.
Claire, do I need a bottle of gin before I listen to this?
Probably yes, but just listen to this, OK? You've got to produce a book for Friends of the Earth.
But, this straight away, she's into the challenge, but the fact that they are expecting her in Radio 1 is the first obvious sign that there's an awful lot of pre-production that's gone on.
I want to talk about that because Simon Mayo sets up the notion that there are ten phone lines.
Now, I did ask, just punt for some suggestions from the 10 million people who are listening at the moment.
Oh, we had to get that in, didn't we? Oh.
And they're all lined up on the phones at the moment, lines 1 to 10. You choose a number.
But I get the sense that, whichever phone line she'd picked of the ten,
funny that, yes,
that she would have been tasked with producing a recycled joke book.
Yes.
Two?
Number two. I'm glad you said number two because It's the one we arranged earlier.
As the show goes on, it's very clear that there's a great deal of contrivance is at work, and a lot of things have been set up in advance. But I don't think that matters.
I don't think it matters. It's something that's fairly obvious to me now. Would that have been obvious to you when you were watching it then?
Well, that's a good point, because I really enjoyed watching this when both now and when I, at the time.
Yeah.
And I think it, even if the younger version of myself was aware of all the planning and production, I think I still would have been excited by it, because they...
It doesn't matter really, does it?
No. I think despite the contrivance and all the preparation, there's enough jeopardy... in the show, and room for unplanned, spontaneous things to happen, for that not to overall count for that much, and you can still get quite caught up in it all.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is down, I think, to the fact that we are told at various points there are 36 hours to go.
No, that's great. That's really good.
Flashes up.
Yeah,
a real sense of time passing.
Yeah.
I want to ask you before we go any further: where do you think Annika ranks in the list of TV's do-gooders?
Well, I think she's right up at the top.
Do you think she's above or below Esther? What's the goal?
What's the goal? Well, that's a tricky one. I think I'd put her above Esther.
Really?
Yeah, because I think there's a more sort of televisual aspect to her brand of fundraising. She's dashing about. She's making things happen. She's driving around in a truck.
There's a lot of branding, isn't there?
There's a lot of branding. I think that's one of the things we kind of mentioned while we were watching the show, that this is 1989, when people probably didn't talk about branding on TV. But Challenge Annika is very well branded as a show.
Yeah.
You've got, there's lots of sort of trademarks within the show. You've got that big truck, which are sort of decked out in the Challenge Annika colours.
Well, there's a colour scheme,
pale,
isn't there,
blue and yellow,
which is reflected in Annika's outfit.
Yes, and she's got a little buggy.
Yes, the logo, everything is very carefully matched.
Yes.
Which gives it a very strong visual identity.
Yes. Yeah.
And I guess that as time went on, that identity became as much a part of, well, more a part of the show, because this was from the first series, but in the later series, as the country became more familiar with the sight of Annika on the challenge programme.
Yes.
Hi, what's a challenge? People stopped, people used to shout out to her, have you found the clue, Annie? Yeah. Where's the clue? But that, in the 90s, that changed to, what's this week's challenge? So it all worked in its favour.
Yeah.
But you'd place her above Esther. What about the kind of watchdog school of do-goodism?
Good evening and welcome to Watchdog Live from Television Centre tonight.
I think Annika's brand of do-goodery is much more appealing than Watchdog.
Yes.
Definitely.
But I think you said during this one that you were slightly disappointed that it wasn't a more sort of grandiose challenge.
It's not the most televisual of challenge. We see people phoning in their jokes. So we see all these kind of telephonists kind of seated at desks.
Taking calls,
writing down jokes.
That's good. You have a watering can, don't you?
That's too political for children.
A depot, you've got a depot.
See someone with a typewriter.
But this is all inside Broadcasting House, we should say. That's fascinating in itself.
But then there's kind of sequences of people donating paper to be recycled. So we just see lots of old paper going into skips, which is a bit boring to watch.
I think, as this particular edition goes on, the novelty of the start, where she's at Radio 1 and there's a lot of, ooh, what's going to happen, gives way to a lot of procedural.
It's slightly mundane,
elements,
isn't it?
Which is necessary to the challenge because the nature of the way a book is produced.
Yeah.
But I think you can see that they try to compensate for that by inserting in sequences which have nothing to do with the challenge.
Yeah.
The perhaps the most blatant one of which is when she goes to a primary school and canvasses small children.
Which is a terrible, terrible idea.
Which fish is the fastest swimmer?
Which fish is the fastest swimmer?
I've forgotten. Sorry about that.
She has a manner.
Yeah.
Of dealing with people,
yeah,
which It can be a little bit flippant at times.
I quite like that though.
She says as she finds things. She tells it as it is. She hasn't got time for pleasantries.
But there's kind of sequences where a number of children say, oh, why did the chicken cross the road? And she kind of goes...
Does anyone know one that isn't about a chicken?
She's quite short with it.
But I quite like that.
There's another sequence quite early on during the Radio 1 section.
Yeah.
Where she started to receive jokes in from people who were ringing in, but she's unhappy with the quality.
Can we say perhaps none of the sort of perversion ones and not all the sort of squashy animals one? This is meant to be an environmental joke book.
And there's one sequence where she's on the phone to Bobby Davrow.
Yes.
But she's quite short with him as well.
You've heard a version of that already from a five-year-old, Bobby. His was marginally funnier, actually.
I want to talk about the title sequence.
I love a title sequence.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
It's amazing. And theme music.
Yes. The title sequence, for those who don't remember it, is a piece of animation.
Yes.
And it shows Annika zipping around the world.
Yeah.
Fixing things.
Yes.
She sews up the Grand Canyon. She sorts out the linear tariff meter so it's straight.
Yeah.
And she's ostensibly delivering a bridge, isn't it? To a stranded lighthouse keeper.
And along the way, she also helps a family of hedgehogs because her Challenge Annika truck almost sort of
squashes them. Yes.
So she creates a little sort of underpass for them to safely cross the road.
This is all part of the branding, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the idea of her as not just a do-gooder, but a go-getter.
Well, almost like a superhero in a funny sort of way.
Because she's given a sort of, in the title sequence, she's transmogrified into like a tornado spinning about the place.
Yeah.
But I think that title sequence sets the tone for the whole series
and it gives
it the feel of almost a kind of a caper.
That's a very good word,
isn't it? Because it's reflected in the pace of it, in the fact that it's there's a lot of running about, lots of people and places and things, but all have to come together at the end.
That's one of the things I kind of wanted to talk about, in that this was a primetime entertainment show. And kind of at this point in time, primetime entertainment shows, certainly on BBC One, they didn't really look like that. You know, it's not a studio-bound show.
No,
it's not light entertainment. This is the start of factual entertainment, isn't it?
Yes, and a kind of entertainment which is sort of warts and all, isn't it?
Yeah,
stuff goes wrong.
There's jump cuts.
There's
kind of slightly, there's handheld camera work.
We see the crew in shots.
It's rough around the edges. Yes. That's the complete antithesis of Bob Says Opportunity Knocks.
Yes. And in fact, I think this particular edition went out just after a Two Ronnies compilation
well,
show.
The sort of the contrast between the two would have been really marked. And I think at this point, it's the first series that's going out on Friday nights. I think later on it moved to Saturday nights. And that was kind of completely a revolution in kind of primetime Saturday night entertainment.
How would you describe Annika's relationship with the public? How do they behave when they see her?
Well, they're glad to see her.
Why is that, do you think?
I think I mentioned to you while we were watching the show that if Annika had not already established that persona and that whole hectic madcap running about character, that would have seemed quite annoying.
It certainly would, yeah.
But having established that, it's you're pleased to see, you would have been pleased to see her.
They do seem genuinely thrilled
when
she appears. And a lot of the people she meets are very unprepossessing office type.
I'm Mark Schedule. I'm a representative of Chase Associates, Lord Kettering.
Give me a clue.
Well, we've done a design for the...
Did you ring in, or...?
Yes, my brother-in-law, he's Geoffrey Bland.
Oh, Geoffrey with the... hang on.
In this particular one, there are an awful lot of men in shirt sleeves and ties.
Yeah, tinted glasses.
Yes, sort of middle management people who are not very articulate.
Yeah.
And yet they kind of swoon when she manages to get them to do exactly what she wants. But I think a lot of that is just the force of her personality.
Yeah, yeah.
She never walks into buildings. She always runs into them.
Yes. And she will kind of sometimes kind of dash into a building and not quite know where she's going.
Well, I think we've got to catch a whole book full there. They're brilliant. Let's find another film room. That's the gym room. Who have we got time here?
Yeah, that's one of the whole.
Well, that's the treasure hunt hallmark,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
she'll go in first and then ask questions later. hello, where's is this the class? Was this the, are you the class? Oh no, down there.
See you later. Thank you. And go next door and try some more. See you later.
There's very much something of the head girl persona about Annika and, yes, and the way she deals with people and the way she manipulates people.
Ooh, yes. Well, she has a way that
in a charming way
of turning a conversation or a request,
yeah,
so that rather than sound quite blunt and perhaps a little bit manipulative, it actually sounds like that you will be doing her a favour.
She's a very difficult person to say no to, isn't she?
Oh yes. And there's a bit at the end where even when she goes up to someone and doesn't know who they are.
This is right at the end, yes, where she's delivering the books to Dylan's booksellers. Yeah.
Rather than going and say, oh hello, oh who are you? She goes, hello, who are you? As if it's like, that's all part of the fun.
Yeah.
She doesn't know who they are.
Yeah.
And they don't mind because they feel that it's part of the fun.
I know. It's actually hugely entertaining to watch.
There seems to me to be a number of essential elements to a challenge.
Okay.
The architecture of the programme.
Mm.
And I want you to see if you agree with these.
Okay.
First of all, lots of rushing about and bustling.
Yeah.
A public service element to proceedings.
The challenge.
Yes, which in this instance is quite, I think, it's quite surprising from a modern day perspective, in that it's very overtly
in aid of Friends of the Earth. Isn't it? Yeah.
But the other challenges would involve something putting, I suppose, a community element.
A kind of charity project. Yes.
Jeopardy is a very important element to it. And in fact, in this programme, I think, maybe I sense that you perhaps thought the Jeopardy element wasn't always there.
It wasn't the most sort of gripping premise in that she had to get 10,000 copies of the book printed and delivered to Dylan's bookshop in London. It didn't really feel like if she failed, that was a kind of a massive
and in fact she does fail
it didn't really seem to matter, did it? She only delivered 1,000 copies. I think a lot of people probably wouldn't have noticed.
Some other elements, lots of infrastructure needs to be on display.
Yes.
You wanted 20,000 meters, you've actually got 21,000
meters of recycled paper,
big machines,
yeah,
technology,
yeah,
large trucks.
Well, it gives it a kind of sense of scale,
yes,
and you know, things are happening, and all this machinery has been put at, you know,
entirely at the disposal of Annika.
Yes, absolutely.
We need to have experts or specialists who pontificate, usually in a quite a dry manner.
Yes.
Now, the printers are at Frome, but the baling setup is also there.
It's in Exeter, which is not that far away, but it has to go to Exeter first for baling before the paper mill can accept it.
And then it goes straight to the mill, which is in Exeter.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the next stage. We'll close the doors and...
Well, kind of what they kind of tend to do is sort of react with mock horror at this impossible premise. But kind of they will kind of
they'll scratch
their heads and kind of, ooh, you know, it's going to be tough. You know, I don't, you know, it's going to be tricky, but, you know, we'll see what we can do.
Yes.
And it's very much that kind of sort of blitz spirit, you know, the back's against the wall, but, you know, it's a good cause,
yes,
and we're going to kind of give it our all.
And connected to that, we need to see lots of technology.
Yes. Well, it's the late 80s, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
So this is our first glimpse of, you know, satellite phones, mobile phones.
Yes, fax machines.
Lots
of mention of the faxes.
Well, people have
been faxed in. I mean, that doesn't actually, thinking about it, that seems rather implausible that most people in the country would be able to fax anything anywhere.
No, but they would have done it at work, surely, Ian. They would have been chatting. Did you hear Simon Mayo this morning? Annika Rice wants to. Take it down.
Tony in IT,
and he will fax it to Radio 1.
And also, I think the last element is a sense of the mood of the times. And I think here, it's very much, as I think was true of the whole series, it's a kind of slightly, not to use a glib phrase, a kind of sort of post-Thatchery, pre-John Majory, caring country.
Well, it's post Live Aid. It's the era of comic relief.
Yes.
But I think the difference with Challenge Annika is that it's not just about, oh, please just send some money and we'll sort everything out. You know, this is kind of more of a kind of community. Everyone's pitching in and offering their services, seeing what they can do to help. It's not just about kind of sending.
And there's a demonstrable. You see the outcome at the end.
Yeah.
You don't, like Children in Need, you know the money, you've pledged the money, but you don't see at the end of the programme where that money has gone. Here you do.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's your payoff. You've both as a viewer and as a donor, you've invested something.
Yeah.
And you get it back at the end.
Yeah.
Throughout the challenge,
there
are a lot of very visible on-screen plugs.
Yes.
And appearances by very well-known high street names.
Well, what do we see, Ian?
Well, we see British Telecom van drive past.
Yeah, but to be fair to them, they're just dumping their old paper, aren't they?
But they get a mention, they get a thank you in the end credit with British Gas.
Yeah.
All of the firms that she mentioned, she has to do with, get mentioned.
Yeah.
Dylan's is in there. I mean, would this sort of thing be possible nowadays?
I'm not sure. I mean, if you watch Children in Need now, they still kind of, there's a lot of brand names on display.
There's still
this quid pro quo that if your company raises a lot of money, you can get your brand and your logo on Children in Need.
Just feels odd on the BBC still. And it's a very when the credits roll on this programme, there's quite a long list of names.
Absolutely.
Of people who are thanked for their assistance. But I suppose Annika herself would say that's part of the deal.
I think it is part of the deal. And there's always the kind of the reasoning that it's all for a good cause.
Of course, yes.
One of the lovely things about this is that through working over the last 2 days on this book, we might well be saving a bit of the countryside or protecting a wildflower or something good is going to come out of it in the end. And let's hope that millions of copies are sold, millions of pounds are made. Then we'll work on the version 2, I think.
And it's interesting that I'd forgotten that Annika herself co-devised this.
Well, we're made very clear of Annika's involvement within the sort of development of the show in the end credits, aren't we? Because she gets not one, but two mentioned in the credits as presenter, but also as co-deviser and executive producer.
That's it, exactly, yes. I think one of the problems is that Annika is one of those few people in television who can be referred to just by her first name.
Well, that's an enormous advantage to her as she's getting on the phone, getting on a satellite
phone. Hi, it's Annika here. People know who she is.
To Nicholas Parsons.
Yes.
It's Annika here.
Oh, hello, hi, There's no need for any more clarification. So the programme has an inbuilt obsolescence almost, in the sense that when Annika decided to finish it, the programme would come to an end.
Yeah.
There was no way that it could survive without her.
See you next week.
Do you think this overall ranks as a vintage challenge?
I don't think it really is. The challenge itself, as worthy as it is, it's not really that visual, is it? It's very difficult to get a handle on it. We don't even see very much of the books.
That's
we
true.
See them coming off the production line, but we don't. There's no close-up of the cover or kind of the flicking through at the book, the jokes and the illustrations. It's not like an edition where maybe she's building an adventure playground,
yes, that's true.
Or an orphanage, and you know, it's kind of still kind of it's only half finished, and you can clearly see the progress or lack of progress. There's none of that in this edition. I think that's what stops it being a vintage challenge, Annika.
Right.
You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched Bob Says Opportunity Knocks from the 10th of April 1987
and Challenge Annika from the 27th of October 1989. Goodbye.
Goodbye.